Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Well, good morning, everybody. We're going to be speaking with none other than socioeconomic research scholar Orrin M. Levin-Waldman. And the latest piece is called The Death of Representation. And it's a very, very compelling issue. Before we get started, you should just know that Orrin M. Levin-Waldman is a faculty member in the School of Public Affairs and Administration at Rutgers University in Newark and socioeconomic research scholar at Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity Research. And if you care to view his perspectives and many issues that he brings forward, you can certainly go to his website at econlabor.com. That's spelled econlabor.com. So good morning, Professor. How are you?
Good morning.
Well, what a pleasure to read this piece. The Death of Representation. My God, what an unbelievable essay. This is so compelling because I don't believe that people recognize, I mean, it's there right in front of our eyes, but I don't know if people recognize that there is no longer representation and there's only allegiance to the parties. And at the moment, we seem to have only two. How did we get to this point? Because we didn't start that way, did we?
We didn't start that way. The idea was that the members of Congress would represent their particular districts, and there would actually be a lot of tension within the congressional district because the interests of each district might, in fact, be different. And then the members of Congress, the House, they would have different interests than the Senate because the constituencies would be larger, so the interests would, in fact, be different again. And the idea was that you'd have to build consensus in order to achieve anything, which meant, by definition, anything that could be achieved would be in very small steps, would be very slow, would be a robust process. But this was the idea that Madison had in mind for protecting individual liberty. Not everybody agreed with this approach. People like Jefferson believed in more democratic governance and ultimately believed in a party system and used the party system when he was president to try to circumvent checks and balances as much as he possibly could. But over the years, we seem to have evolved into a party system. We have greater party allegiance. And even, I think, as late as, 40, 50 years ago, you still have members of Congress, even if they were aligned with their parties, they would still tend to be more focused on what their individual districts were telling them to do. Lately, the last 10, 15 years, we seem to have more allegiance to party, even at the expense of representing your district's interests.
So how do people in America really understand? Because I don't know if I really fully understood. This is a republic. And what does that say about the country if it's a republic, democratic republic?
People don't really understand what a republic is, and they don't really understand what it means. We bandy this term democracy around as though it's a foregone conclusion. Everybody understands what that means. True democracy in the Athenian style democracy was citizens would actually go to the town square and vote on issues of the day. You'd represent yourself, period. That was it. But the number of people who could actually participate in the process was actually very limited. Only a small number of people could be considered to be citizens. If you were a slave, you certainly could not vote. If you didn't own property, in many cases, you couldn't vote either. But the idea of a republic was to have what they called representative democracy. And even that was limited. So the idea was you'd select representatives to speak on your behalf, to vote on your behalf. And they, in turn, would, in theory, promote the public good. So the House of Representatives was conceived to be a representative democracy close to the people. The people would actually select the representatives in the House. Mm-hmm. And they would do it every 2 years on the theory that the more frequently you have an election, the closer you are to the people themselves. The Senate, however, was conceived very differently. There was some discussion that maybe it should be an aristocracy of talent to be distinguished from a landed aristocracy, but for the most part, those who had talent, in other words, those who were highly educated, probably came from wealthy families that also owned considerable land. So, but anyway, the idea was, initially, some proposals called for the House of Representatives to select the Senate. And then, you know, we got these various compromises, two states, two senators from each state to denote co-equal sovereignty among the states. The states would actually, the state legislatures initially would select two senators for each state. And that changed in 1908 with an amendment to the Constitution calling for direct election of senators. But still, a senator representing a higher state has a different constituency than each member of the House representing a particular district. So in a sense, what you have is you don't have direct democracy. And in fact, the framers of the Constitution really took a very dim view of democracy. They were very concerned that democracy could devolve into what they called mobocracy, ruled by the irrational passions of the mob.
So when we look at it the way it's evolved over time, from the beginning of the nation to the present and the permutations that have occurred, is there any way that we can actually define in advance who we're voting for? Because nowadays, all these people who stand up for elected office for the House or for the Senate, they just tell us things that I don't even know what they tell us. They don't tell us where they stand specifically. They're only aligned by the party, whatever the party says, that's what the way they're going to align themselves with. And there is no discussion, and there's no discourse, and there's no way of knowing what these people are going to do when they get into elected office. So we vote for them because we like the clothes that they wear or the way they look or the cars they drive or who knows what. So have we lost it now? I mean, is it over? There is no representation anymore because we haven't been listening to the middle class for decades.
That's true. But if you go back to studies from the late 40s and early 1950s, you know, VOK identified the voting patterns and basically suggested that people, for the most part, they vote their party allegiance. They vote, if you're a Democrat, you're a Democrat because your father was a Democrat, whose father, also father,
yeah,
was also a Democrat, you know, you can go down through history. You know, if you had deep cleavages in the country, which could cause a realignment where people would actually change their party affiliation, then you'd see maybe change in the composition of the government itself. Now, what you're seeing in more recent years, since the 60s, is what we call a party de-alignment, where people are rejecting parties and they're becoming more independent. So the reality is, when you're talking about national elections, they're not fought among the party bases. The party bases are faithful, so you already know that you have a good 30% of the eligible electorate will vote Republican, and 30% of the eligible electorate, maybe 33% of each party, will vote for the Democratic. So you're really playing to independents who haven't made up their mind. Those are people in the middle. And so, in a sense, what you have, members of Congress from each respective party are really taking their bases for granted. And it's rather interesting to note that if you have an important issue come of the day and it's being discussed or it's a breaking news and you ask a member of Congress, for some reason, they all seem to parrot the same party line. They don't seem to be capable of thinking for themselves. It's almost as though they had a discussion in their party caucus. What is our official party line going to be today on this particular issue? And that's not what representation is really about.
Well, evidently, we've lost representation because the party is now the ultimate boss and whatever the party decides. And then what's going on with respect to all the people that are switching parties now? At one time, I guess they were switching to Republican. Now they're switching to Democrat. What are they representing, or do we know? Or is it that the people who switch party allegiances or alliances are really just going for the votes because they think they'll get more votes as a Democrat as opposed to a Republican or vice versa?
Well, that's traditionally what a broker party model was all about. You align yourself with whatever party will get you the most votes, and where you move, whichever way the mood appears to be swinging, that's the direction you head in. Now, that means that there is really no ideological commitment to a party. The party changes, and parties, in fact, have changed. It's not clear that people understand what they're getting when they sign up to for a particular party. For the most part, people who change their vote from one election to the next are probably independent. They're not really committed party partisans.
Mm-hmm. And is there a greater, a directive or impact on people in local government than on the national scale? Or is that now permutation that's in every form of government we have in the U.S. now?
I think it's probably more the case that we're seeing at the national level. I mean, at the state and local level, people are more fixated on local concerns or issues that affect their daily lives in a more direct way. In a city like New York, where you basically only have one effective party, then the political battles are fought in the primary level. So, it even pays to, if you're a Republican, to register as a Democrat so you can select have a hand in the selection of the candidates who will in fact be running.
And we are starting to see where the parties are demanding allegiance no matter what, and they're not interested in any back talk or discussion. And they've demonized many people on the left and on the right because they don't fit into the dogma and the promotion of what the party wants at that time. Is that where we've become now? These people have become pariahs?
They have. The parties basically became extraordinarily more ideological beginning in the Reagan years. It accelerated with Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House and with his contract with America and became increasingly more partisan. And I think, quite frankly, we've seen a lot of this play out, beginning with Barack Obama's presidency, where basically the party leaders leaned on people to vote for the Affordable Care Act, regardless of how it was going to play in respective districts.
Mm-hmm. So where do we go from here? Why didn't we evolve to the point where we may have more than one party? So we don't have just a Republican Party. We don't just have a Democratic Party. Why didn't we follow or emulate what the Europeans have, which seems to have a much more robust discussion, even though it usually ends up being either this way or that way, but at least it's a discussion before you get to that point where things are formalized either this way or that way. We don't have that. And so we can't appreciate the nuances and the circumstance of new legislation or positioning?
Yeah, the short answer is the U.S. has single-member districts and winner-take-all elections. So basically, only one person can represent a particular district, and it's basically the winner takes all. So it's the strongest parties remain in power or remain in the competition. The weaker parties tend to fall by the wayside. So this has basically been the common answer for why we don't have what we call a responsible party model, which is more likely what you see in Europe, where you have multi-member districts where basically you're selecting five people to represent a particular province in a European country. So they can have different ideological views, and you can represent, you can have different five different ideologies representing your province, if that's what you want, but then you have a greater commitment to the party. In the U.S., it really has been what we call a broker party model, where the goal is to win elections, which means parties shift their positions back and forth, and they only adopt positions which they feel are utilitarian, which will actually enable them to win the election. But I think what we've seen in more recent years is a more cracking of the whip by party leaders with regards to their members, so that the members do not stray. And, you know, there's clearly a narrative. There's clearly a narrative with this January 6th committee, whatever you want to call it. There's a narrative on the other side. And there's no real attempt to find out really what happened or to learn anything. The conclusions are already preordained.
Wow. And so... do people recognize? Well, first of all, why does the public buy into this dogma, either Republican or Democrat, Democrat or Republican? Why do we buy into that? How do we conform to what these parties are trying to tell us? And why do we?
And the parties are strong enough that they can raise enough money that they can manipulate the public in either particular direction. I think the other issue that you're seeing, particularly in the wake of Trump's presidency, is that basically Trump was what we could call a binary. It was a dichotomous variable. You either for him or you're against him. If you really hated him, it didn't really matter who replaced him. It didn't really matter what policies replaced his policies. The fact is you're voting for somebody who was simply not Trump. But you weren't necessarily voting for Biden or anybody else. You were voting against Trump. And so we've come to the point where anything that Trump did is absolutely bad. We have to say that.
Yeah.
And anything that is the opposite of Trump, it must be good. We're not even thinking about what the implications of that are.
Yeah, because we don't rationalize. Look, not everything that Trump did was irrational or undermined the capacity of the public to make a decision. Or the Senate or the Congress to weigh in. But how did we get to this adversarial position where nothing seems to matter except who's going to win? I hate him or I hate her, and that's the way it goes. And you never get a discussion.
I think it begins to a certain extent with Bush's election in 2000, where, you know, you either hated him or you liked him, and so what you saw was, okay, so Barack Obama becomes president. He then has to undo everything that Bush did with executive orders. Because it was Bush, and I'm not Bush. Then Trump becomes president, and he has to undo everything Obama did by executive order, because, you know, obviously he's not Obama. Now Biden has become president. He has to undo everything that Trump did, because, you know, he's not Trump. Without even thinking through the consequences of what you're doing, and the fact in the process you're actually hurting people, like canceling pipelines here and there and whatnot, and good union jobs, that's because Trump did it. I have to oppose it. And I think, again, if you're playing to your base, which is what a lot of these people are doing, the base sees nothing wrong with that. It's the independents that you have to be concerned about, who are going to look at this and say, especially in the next election, why did you do this? And, you know, you're hoping that their memory is short, so by the time the next election, if you do this early enough in your presidency, you're hoping that by the time the next election rolls around in 4 years, they'll have forgotten all about it.
So where does this lead us to, or does it? Or just we've come to a stalemate, and now I guess we're going to be fighting for the independent voter? Is that where we're going? Are we already there? How does that represent the nation, though? Even if they're independent voters, they might be independent on one position or another, but not on everything. Is that cohesive?
It's not cohesive, and you know that's certainly a way. It's certainly an approach. We've already been doing that, but it means that you really, to a certain extent, you have to abandon your base in order to appeal to the independent voter who tends to be in the middle. As some people have learned in both parties, particularly the progressives and the Democratic Party, that if you expand your base through registration drives and whatnot, you don't have to listen to independents either.
Uh-huh. And is this where we're going? Are we trying to engage more people to register to vote? Because there are a lot of people in the country who never even registered to become American citizens. Are they going to start to consider registering to become a citizen? And let's face it, in America, you could hold more than one citizenship. That's permitted. So I never understood why people didn't want to become American citizens.
You know, there may be a whole array of reasons for why they don't want to do it, but, you know, they certainly can't vote if they're not a citizen, but, there are a lot of people who are eligible to vote who are not registered to vote, and that's really why we have such low voter turnout. One of the things they seem to do amidst COVID was register more people to vote. I think the carrot that you can do it via mail. You don't appear. I think, which probably is somewhat off the mark, but that was the appeal, and they're still trying to make that appeal and make it permanent.
Mm-hmm. So where do we go then from here, when the public is dismissed too often? And the voter is not sure who they're voting for anyway, and then there are people within the party system that you would like even the AOCs of the world, which you point out, these are independent thinkers. They don't really conform to the party line, and they're manipulating from the bottom up in order to get their dogma or get their perspectives taken, which doesn't always align with everybody. So how do we contend with that? Because they're not the only voice, and yet they make the biggest noise.
Well, I mean, I think they've sort of latched on to this strategy, which says, if you are not with us, you're against us. If you're against us, you must be a traitor to the cause.
But I think what you're seeing
in Pelosi's Congress is she has such ironclad control of pretty much her caucus, because Speaker controls, part of assignments to various committees. What committee you're on is very essential to your ability to represent your particular district. She rules ruthlessly with an iron hand. Now, that anybody who expected her to rule any differently, it would boggle the mind. I mean, this is somebody who doesn't come from California. She comes from Baltimore, where machine politics were the norm. So she understands machine politics, and she understands it very well. She grew up at the foot of her father, who was mayor of Baltimore,
Amazing. And what happens to people like Liz Cheney? She's a Republican. She was in the GOP leadership, and then, you know, now they booted her out because she doesn't conform to, I guess, whatever the dogma is, or the I guess the line of the day. How do these people survive? Then there's this guy named, I think, was it in Chanin or Manson? On the Republican, on the Democratic side, why are these people being demonized? Is this the way you whip these people in under control?
That's the objective. Again, mm-hmm. It's you conform to the party line or get out, or be thrown out, which is the case in Cheney's case, and even Manchin's now considering not running for another term. So either the pressure is getting to him, or what he could do, might be smart for him to do, is to consider shifting party.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe that's the way. The only way he's got, if he wants to stay in power as a representative. What are people voting for when they vote for these people? Are they voting for the party line? Do they understand exactly what the party line is? Or are we just ignorant and we're voting because, well, they're in power, seems like they're nice people, whatever?
See,
I have no idea why people vote.
There, I think, this is where we have a big disconnect and people misunderstand what the last election was really all about. To a certain extent, what 2016 was all about. It really, people weren't voting for anything in particular. They were voting against what was there already. And they were really voting to reject Trump in 2020. They weren't really choosing overly liberal, progressive, socialist policies of the Democratic Party, contrary to what the progressives in the party think. They really weren't choosing that. But they figured, well, we won, so let's push for our mandate. We think we have a mandate. But again, the Republicans said exactly the same thing. And when Bush was elected, we won, even though it didn't have a mandate. We have a mandate because we won. And we're going to push to our agenda as much as we can. So there was no difference here in terms of parties misreading the public. But that's precisely what they did. People were voting against Trump. It was really an anti-Trump vote, more than it was a pro-Biden vote. And we can see that Biden's approval rating seems to be slipping at the moment. There's no coherence to half of what he says. There's no coherence to what the administration is trying to push. Nobody really understands what it's trying to accomplish, other than he has to be the anti-Trump, whatever that means. So that's where we are.
So was it Representative Kinzinger? I think he's from Illinois. They want him out of the party as well. Are they going to beat up enough people so that nobody's going to ever sway from the dogma of the party system? It looks like we're really coming to the point where there won't be any voice to be heard within the party system. And it'll be one way or the other.
They want Kinzinger out because he voted for Donald Trump's impeachment. So you're not allowed to do that if you're Republican. So, again, if you had a system whereby you were actually listening to your constituents, then you would vote on that basis, not on what the party demands. If they have the power to deny you, to make your life miserable, in that party and deny you plum assignments to the various committees, then you will get the message on your own, it's time to leave Congress. That's the hope in the case of Liz Cheney. I think it's interesting to note that when Pelosi selected people to be on this panel, she specifically made sure that the two Republicans were people who voted for impeachment, not Republicans who actually supported Trump.
Yeah. So it just seems that we're at a stalemate, and why is it that the people who are in elected office are concerned about getting all those plum jobs? Is that about their earning a larger salary as opposed to just being a representative and speaking for the public interest? Do they not make enough money unless they're a member of this board or that interest group within the party system?
Being
that
a member,
more important than anything else?
I think it's important to a lot of people to have money and power, and then being a member of Congress
puts
you in a position, at least, even if you feel that your $175,000 a year salary is limited, you pay for two houses, but if you feel it's limited, you're in a position to make more money. You can get money from speaking engagements. You can make a lot of money by writing a book, which is more likely to be published because you are a member of Congress, and the list can go on. And you're basically in a position where you can make money, and you can make money after leaving office. We have seen in recent years, particularly with the exit of Clinton from the presidency, is that after being president, you can become a millionaire, a multimillionaire, in ways that you couldn't in the past. So, I mean, here's somebody who walks into office with no money, didn't even own his own home, walks out of office worth millions of dollars, has several homes now, and he made all this money from speaking engagements and writing his memoirs.
That's amazing.
So people are actually profiting from having been in office.
And the public doesn't seem to connect that, do they? Why do we buy into this process that is failing the basic interests of most people? Whether Republican or Democrat makes no difference. We're not conforming to the needs of, I guess, a republic, the people who count themselves as Republican, or conforming to people who believe that they're Democrats. So what are we voting for? Why are we even engaged? Why is the government standing?
I think the public is jaded. They don't really think that things will change much. And just because somebody says they're for the middle class doesn't mean they really are. The policies they pursue are policies which will be beneficial to them specifically, but not necessarily to the general masses out there. That's the way much of the public probably sees it these days. The other thing is, I think there are a lot of people. The question you have to ask is why did Trump win the support of all these blue-collar voters who clearly did not in any way reflect their economic circumstances? That he certainly wasn't going to pursue an agenda which in any way would lift them up. In fact, he had pursued an agenda which hurt more blue-collar workers in the past because of all the bankruptcies and basically left them high and dry. Why do they support this guy? And I think, and Trump probably identified the variable most that, which seems to be people vote for people they think are winners and not people they perceive to be losers. That's why you'd see Trump stacking his cabinet with multimillionaires. Because they're winners, they're not losers. If you don't make a lot of money, even if you make the money by stealing it, you're a chump. You're a loser. You're not a winner. And people are voting for the person they perceive to be the winner. And Trump instinctively understood this. This is how you sell yourself. I'm a winner. I live by conspicuous consumption, and people admire that, and because of that, they'll vote for me. But Trump also understood something else. He understood that even if he lost the 2016 election, which he probably expected him to do, that he would still win in the sense that his brand would become more profitable, more people would patronize his hotels, more people would buy his products. He'd be the winner.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's turned out to be that way, but, maybe so. And then why is there an alignment? People may dislike Trump, and they can legitimize that. On the other hand, people say they like Biden, and they can legitimize that as well. at the end, they don't seem to be that different, do they? As far as positions, there was a problem with people coming across the border, and it's gotten worse since Trump left and under Biden. And that's got to increase the capacity of people getting infected because they're not tested when they come here. They're not getting inoculations. I don't know if they should or shouldn't, but the point is they're getting across the border. What does that do to our safety? Or does it?
It raises some serious problems. It raises some inconsistencies, if you want to call it, if that's putting it nicely, yeah. I suppose. If you say, oh, well, you know, we'll let people in across the border if they test positive for COVID, but meanwhile, we'll recommend people wear masks in highly infectious areas.
Yeah. And we're supposed to decide that on our own, as if we're going to know.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So where do we go from here? Is the public so consumed with the reality that they may not fully comprehend, not that I certainly do, fully, and it's hard to even recognize that these things are happening because they've been subtle. They've been like, you know, little increments, one step today, another step tomorrow, and so on and so forth, and this is where we've come. And how can we really survive when it's the parties that make a decision and so many people may be left out of the equation? So if you're one party, you're dismissing the other, and then the independents, why are they voting? And who are they voting for? And why are they voting no longer independent? Why are they going Democrat or Republican or vice versa? Do we get that, or is it personalities?
It has become personalities in more recent years, certainly at the presidential level. But at the congressional level, people are still, for the most part, voting for the parties. And, you know, you traditionally vote. I mean, if you take New York, if you live in a mostly Democratic state, then you can expect the state will remain Democratic. Most congressional districts at this point are heavily Democratic, and they will remain so. And it will be interesting to see if the Republican challenger can defeat Cuomo. I suspect he probably can, only because New Yorkers seem to have an aversion to electing a governor for a fourth term.
And I tend to think something will come out of the allegations of sexual impropriety by him. There were a lot of issues that were brought up. I don't know if they've ever been formalized in lawsuits or anything like that, but that's coming into play as well. But can someone like an Astorino, who has failed quite a few times, can he win as a governor?
It's difficult. It's not impossible. You had in Pennsylvania, you had Bob Casey run for governor four times before he finally won. So
that's
it does happen. It doesn't happen too often, but it does happen. I'm thinking more in terms of Lee Zeldin in Long Island, the representative of Congress, who may have the strongest chance of beating Cuomo.
Right. That's going to be very interesting to see. Why the divide between conservatives and Republicans? What's the point of that? Certainly on the local level, it seems to be the case.
I think that you've just simply had this alignment take place beginning with the Reagan years, Tom. There's really no the Republican Party, particularly in places like New York and Connecticut, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, was more moderate before Reagan. It was, you know, we used to refer to it as the Rockefeller Republicans. You know, they'd be, you know, conservative on economic issues, very liberal on social issues. And that really changed when Reagan became president, and the party became more ideological and more ideologically conservative. To the point where
is it possible
saw Republicans move over to the Democratic Party.
Uh-huh. is it possible today for someone to run for political office? Maybe they have leanings one way or the other, but at the end of the day, their purpose and their capacity to win is that they have the educational background to do the job, not that they just want to be, you know, a servant of the public with no knowledge, no education, no understanding of the issues. Can someone like that, who's credible from that perspective rather than a particular dogma, can they win? Or is that no longer part and parcel of the game plan? And now you're either a Republican or a Democrat or a Republican.
I think what you are seeing are a lot of candidates who are making the argument, see, I have credentials, I have a degree, I'm part of the elite, vote for me, I know better than you what to do, so therefore I should hold office and make decisions. That seems to be more the case on the Democratic Party side than the Republican Party side, but it's there too. But it's also feeds into the same elitism, which basically says, well, if the party is basically telling this particular party line, I expect people to support me because that is, in fact, the party line.
Well, where does competency come in, or does it? Or have we forgotten that? You know, I mean, who do you vote for?
There's no real requirement that one has to be competent in order to hold office. You know, it's basically the only requirement that one has for to be a member of Congress is they have to be 25 years old, period.
Right.
And the only requirement of to be a member of the Senate is you have to be 30 years old. And even for president, just simply has 35 years old, and you have to be a natural-born American citizen. Other than that, it doesn't really spell out a list of requirements, like it's a job, job application, based that you have to have degrees or advanced degrees or whatever.
Well, I wasn't looking so much for any advanced degrees or stuff like that. I was just wondering... Like people have to be engaged in budgets. There's certain people that oversee budgets. If you don't understand how to read a ledger and you don't understand finances, you don't understand how the banking system works, you don't know when to buy bonds on the market, and so on and so forth, then what good are you other than just you want to be in politics and this is a way you could dabble in it, but that doesn't mean you understand it. And if you don't understand it, your vote might undermine the entire process. And then the public that voted for you, they don't even realize that. So why are they voting? Who are they voting for? Not that, maybe at one time it was all elitism, right? You came from a good family. You came from a lot of money. Like you were a winner, as they say. But how does that translate to today?
Today, it's anybody who can raise funds to run in a primary election or get enough signatures to put them on the ballot can run. And that the so-called norms, as they may have existed before, no longer exist.
No longer.
You know, it used to be the norm. You select somebody who came from the genteel class, they were WASP or whatever. And that was displaced. They were displaced by the party machines in the 1800s. And then if you change the rules of the game to allow for only people with merit to seek office, then, you know, you define merit. Well, merit was defined by somebody who, you know, graduated from Harvard or Yale or someplace. But that's no longer the case. I think there is an expectation, at least at the presidential level, that the person will have graduated a college and will have a degree in something. There is certainly that norm. By the way, there's no real formal requirement that justices on the Supreme Court have to have a law degree.
Well, I never knew that.
that they don't have to be lawyers. It never says they have to be, but it has become a norm over the last, you know, 50, 100 years that Supreme Court justices will have, in fact, been lawyers. But it raises an interesting question. There have been constitutional scholars who have been had PhDs in political science, and they've written wonderful tomes on the Constitution and cases and whatnot. They could, why couldn't they have been appointed to the Supreme Court? It's also the case that any number of Nobel Prize winners in economics are not really economists. They're psychologists or mathematicians or whatever. But, there's certainly a norm that if you're applying for a job to be an economics professor in any school in the country, you will be a formally trained economist, regardless of what the Nobel Committee is doing. There are certain norms that evolve over time, but they're not necessarily legal requirements. Some parties have made these norms sort of, rules, in a sense that they look askance at people who don't have the formal credentials that say, since Barack Obama went to Harvard and he went to Columbia, then every candidate should, in their view, also have the same mm-hmm. types of degrees.
Mm-hmm. Is that part of the bias, though, too, that we don't allow people from all walks of life and that we expect them to be lawyers for one thing or another? But when does competency come into play? Shouldn't one have experience other than I'm a nice guy, I want to be a politician, I want to earn the money, and what do you bring to the equation? I mean, how did someone like an AOC get into office? Because maybe the community she wanted to represent were ill represented before. Whoever was there before, I forgot his name, but he was really quite complacent, and he thought that he would win again. She was maybe more out there and tried to reach people. And there must have been, there also was some sort of a color line as well that somehow influenced voters too. So where are we going with all of this? Is it racism? Is it ethnicity? What are we voting for? And what are we going to get from it?
Well, in her case, nobody ever accused her of having any real competence. But, she appealed to demographics that put her in the office, and she also profited from the fact that only 10% of her district was participating in the primaries, and that basically was enough to get her elected. And then once she was nominated, then there was no real opposition to her in that district. One wonders if the incumbent had decided to run as independent against her, if she wouldn't have lost in the initial race.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's very, very interesting. Where do we go from here? Are we just wandering aimlessly? Will we ever get the nation to be representative of the public, of the nation, in a way where predominantly people will say, hey, well, they speak for me. This is what I really believe in. Or are we going to be swayed by listening to Fox News on the one hand, or listening to something else that's more left on the other hand? Where do we go? What validates our thinking, or does it?
Well, unfortunately, news media and social media are validating our thinking, and basically, you have the conservative Republican echo chamber, or maybe it's the pro-Trump echo chamber in Fox News and a few other stations, and talk radio on the AM side in the New York metro area. You certainly have that, but you have the echo chamber for the Liberal Democrats, progressives, and MSNBC, CNN, and a few other stations. So, we don't really have honest debate, and we gravitate to the stations that seem to reflect our way of thinking. So if you really believe that vaccines are not helpful, and you really believe that people calling for or telling you may want to wear a mask, the CDC didn't really say you have to wear a mask, contrary to what Fox News is reporting. If you really believed it's a violation of your civil liberties and all that, as well as having a Excelsior pass is also a violation of your civil liberties, by all means, listen to Fox News, because they will tell you exactly what you want to hear. If you believe that this is really a problem, the COVID, the rise in cases is really a problem of specifically the unvaccinated in rural America and the red states, then by all means, go listen to CNN, because, you know, that reflects your viewpoint. Never mind the fact that what you really have is in large urban areas like New York City and Chicago, you have large minority populations that are simply unvaccinated.
I don't understand why people stay unvaccinated, and then, you know, people come in with COVID, whether it be the Delta virus that is killing people, you know, to an over 80% to 90%. Where is that going to go? And then there's another one, another variant that I hear is coming out called Lambda. So this is getting worse and worse, but are we gonna realize that, you know, if you don't get inoculated, a lot of people are going to be dying, and they are dying. So when does one figure out that the dogma is no longer good? When does one decide it's better to live than to believe in dogma?
I don't know. If we haven't figured it out yet, I'm not sure we will figure it out in the future.
Yeah, well, we're going to need to. Eventually, we're going to get an answer. I guess maybe the funeral parlors are going to tell us exactly what's going to happen. They'll be the canary in the mine. So when enough people drop dead, we'll know what happens. It's amazing. Do you understand exactly why people are reluctant to get the vaccine?
I don't really understand it. I mean, I've heard various theories. You know, one is it's emergency authorized use right now, and as opposed to the FDA coming out and giving it full approval. But reading the Wall Street Journal today, that apparently some polls suggested it would only affect 8% if you had full authorization from the FDA. So that included, that would make a big difference. What I find to be really perplexing is that Trump did push through vaccine development with Operation Warp Speed, and yet it's his own followers that seem to be reluctant to get the vaccine, which I find perplexing
that.
Itself. I don't really understand that I think a lot of people have been swayed into believing that, you know, if you have restrictions and you have to wear, and there's no point in getting a vaccine, and therefore don't do it. And I think, you know, people on Fox News like Tucker Carlson, Lauren Ingraham are doing a lot to dissuade people from getting the vaccine, even though they claim not to be. They claim to be. They probably vaccinated themselves, but that's a whole different issue.
Yeah. Unbelievable, just unbelievable where we've come. Do you find that when you look at what's happening here in the United States, do we have similarities in other countries? I mean, is Canada going through the same process that we are, or any place in Europe that's going similarly in similar directions? Are the Brits, the Brits are usually quite often compared to the United States. Are they still representing their constituency well?
Britain is also a two-party system for the most part. So, you know, they also tend to be more polarized along the Liberal Party, the Conservative Party. But you do have a few more parties in Britain, but they're very minor parties. Then you have multi-party systems where you don't have enough of a majority to cross that threshold, then you need coalitions, then you have unstable governments. So it's sort of like pick your poison. Now, arguably, the unstable governments are probably the most more democratic government when you talk about want to preserve and protect our democracy. I was never understand what that term means. We are fighting for our democracy, whatever that means. Democracy means something different to different people.
Right.
But for those in power, it means you don't challenge us.
Well, it's interesting, like in Israel, they cobbled together a coalition that people thought would break apart right away. It's not that it's been that long. You know, you never know when it could fall apart with one or two parties of one or two people pulling away. That could make the difference between survival or a call for new elections. Do you think that they're more representative of the different facets of Israeli society? Or is that just a unique situation? It's almost like an aberration. Because they used to be very much aligned on party lines as well. And there were very big parties and very, very, very small parties.
If the coalition is to survive, then they do have to be more representative of all different factions within
yeah.
the country. And I'm not convinced that the government's going to last much beyond the budget discussions.
Exactly.
But all you need is another war with Hamas, and then basically the government falls apart.
Wow. Well, very, very interesting and always compelling to talk to you, Professor Oren M. Levin-Waldner. What a pleasure. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. I think it's woken up a lot of people, including myself. You know, you somehow are able to dive right into the center of things and just show us the fault lines, which I'm very thankful for, because it makes me think. So thank you.
Thank you.
All the best. Thank you very much. Well, there we are, folks. None other than Oren M. Levin-Waldner. His latest essay you can read online. Bear with me a moment here. I want to make sure that I have it in front of me. I don't want to give you the wrong label because I did see that I made an error in publishing today's show. So let me just bear with me a moment here. We'll get that in a second. All right, one moment. Too many things on the table here. So let's just see. Get to that in a moment. I'll be the next speaker, so unfortunately I can dawdle in trying to figure all of this stuff out. I've got too many pages that are open, which happens too frequently. Bear with me a moment here. Okay, and this is what I wanted to get to. Okay, here we are, almost there. Okay. Well, okay, here it is. So the essay that he wrote for this particular week is called The Death of Representation. It's written by Oren M. Levin-Waldner, and I think it's a worthy read. It's what we discussed, but maybe possibly I think even more in depth than we spoke about on the radio. You should remember that Oren M. Levin-Waldner is a faculty member in the School of Public Affairs and Administration at Rutgers University, Newark, and he's also a socioeconomic research scholar at the Global Institute for Sustainable Prosperity Research. You could find him on his own website at econlabor.com. That's econlabor.com. And if you go there, you could also find his email address. And just so you get an understanding of the depth of his range, he's written quite a few books. One is called The Author of Restoring the Middle Class Through Wage Policy, Arguments for a Middle Class, published by Palgrave. And then you've got Understanding Public Policy in the United States. This one is published by Top Hat, T-O-P-H-A-T. Then there's the minimum wage, a reference handbook. This is written or published rather by ABC-CLIO. It's the ABC-CLIO corporate publishing firm. And then there's wage policy, income distribution, and democratic theory. This is now even available in paperback, and this is published by a very esoteric publishing house called Routledge, R-O-U-T-L-E-D-G-E, Routledge. And then there's a case of the minimum wage competing policy models, and this one is published by the State University of New York Press. So SUNY Press, S-U-N-Y Press. And again, you could find him on his own website at www.econlabor.com. His email address is there, very easy though, olevinwaldman@gmail.com. And that's it. You'll find more information about him there on the website. Okay, so let's quickly go back to, okay, we're here. What I want to do now then is go with you to some other, okay, we're going to move on to what's going on the international stage. Sean Patterson Howard, the mayor of Mount Vernon, will join us at 11:30. And so I look forward to speaking to her then. In the meantime, what we're going to do is we're going to find out what's going on the international stage. So, now this is very interesting. With regard to the COVID-19 crisis, France turns out to be the only European Union country not exempt from the UK travel quarantine, which is very interesting. People fully vaccinated in the United States and European Union, except for France, will be allowed to travel to England without having to quarantine on arrival, the UK government announced today. So we're helping reunite people living in the United States and European countries with their families and friends, so said the Transport Minister Grant Shapps, who tweeted it, adding that the policy will come into force from around 4 o'clock local a.m. time on August 2nd. Well, travelers fully jabbed or vaccinated with a vaccine approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration or the European Medicine Agency will be able to travel from any country on the British government's Amber traffic light list without having to self-isolate at home for 10 days. And they will still need to do a pre-departure test and take another test on day 2 after arriving in England. Well, separate rules will continue to apply for those arriving from France and those traveling from an Amber List country, which includes most of Europe and the United States, who are not fully vaccinated will still have to quarantine on arrival. Well, the government also confirmed the restart of international cruises. Quote, this is progress and we can all enjoy, wrote Shapps. Britain is in the midst of another wave of the virus due to the so-called Delta variant, although case numbers have dropped over the past week, while its vaccine drive has seen more than 70% of adults fully vaccinated. Well, the devolved governments of Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland set their own health policies and decide their own foreign travel rules. So that's going to be very interesting on how they cope with all these different changes. One second. Well, this is very interesting, actually. In this case, it's also from France. France fines Monsanto for illegally acquiring data on journalists and activists. That's interesting. France's Personal Data Protection Agency on Wednesday fined U.S. firm Monsanto for illegally compiling lists, or rather files, of public figures, journalists, and activists with the aim of swaying opinion towards support for its controversial pesticides. the firm now owned by German chemical giant Bayer, B-A-Y-E-R, or Bayer in English, failed to inform the people on the watch list compiled in the context of a heated public debate about glyphosate, a weed killer it ruled. Well, the CNIL agency fined Monsanto €400,000, that's about $475,000, in the case brought by seven plaintiffs. Well, compiling a list of contacts was not in itself illegal, the agency said, but only people who could, quote, reasonably expect, end quote, to figure on such lists because of their business sector or their public standing should have been included. Furthermore, the data had to be collected legally and targets informed, including of the right to refuse being listed. And by keeping the list secret, Monsanto deprived them of this right, CNIL had said. Monsanto gave a rating of 1 to 5 to each of the over 200 people on its French list, corresponding to their estimated influence, credibility, and level of support for Monsanto on several topics, especially pesticides and genetically modified crops. The case was reported by French media Le Monde, which means the world in French, and France 2 television in 2019, quickly spread to other European countries where Monsanto was also keeping lists. Lawyers hired by Bayer, which had acquired Monsanto the previous year, said that they found close to 1,500 politicians, journalists, and others, quote, located primarily within the European Union, end quote, on, quote, stakeholder lists, end quote, maintained by Monsanto's public relations agency, Fleischmann Hillaud. Well, in a separate, published by Bayer, the U.S.-based law firm Sidley Austin added that it had found no evidence of illegal surveillance activity surrounding the watch lists. Well, in a statement sent to Agence France-Presse on Wednesday, Bayer said that the French authority had considerably reduced, quote-unquote, the initial scope of its allegations against the firm. But CNIL's ruling still differed from Bayer's own view that the lists were legal, it said. Okay. Now, let me just quickly look to see what's happening here on, where are we here? Okay. I want you to move on to some other issues. One moment here. Now, this is very interesting. It seems that Lebanon's crisis is contributing to tension along the border with Israel. So it seems Israel and Lebanon exchanged rocket fire last week after two suspects crossed over from Lebanon into northern Israel, leading to an hours-long manhunt. The two men turned out to be African immigrants, but tensions remain high along the border. We observe everything that is happening on the Lebanese side, especially if there are attempts to penetrate into Israeli territory to smuggle weapons, drugs, and terrorist activity, says Israeli Captain Simon, who did not give his last name or allow his face to be filmed because he is part of an Israeli surveillance unit. This unit is the first to issue an alert so that the special forces and infantry can intervene. And Israeli forces foiled several infiltration attempts in recent weeks. The crisis in Lebanon only makes things more unpredictable. We assume there is a link between Hezbollah and smuggling that has been going on recently, Captain Simon said. We can also see, with the situation in Lebanon, an increase in the smuggling of arms and drugs. Israel is also tracking tunnels dug by the Shiite Islamist group with an aim to infiltrate Israel. There's no doubt that the next war will be very hard. This is something we take seriously, said another Israeli army officer, Major David. Israel estimates that in case of war, Hezbollah will have the capacity to fire 3,000 rockets a day into Israel. So that's the crisis over there along the border, and potentially could get worse. One second. This is very interesting. In Bangladesh, the Bangladesh has evacuated 10,000 Rohingya from a landslide hit camp. Well, Bangladesh has evacuated 10,000 Rohingya from around refugee camps on the Myanmar border after monsoon landslides and flash floods killed at least 14 people, officials said today. After 3 days of torrential rain, the refugees, most of whom fled a military crackdown in Myanmar in 2017, were moved from hilly slopes around the Balukali camp in Cox's Bazar, a refugee commissioner, Shah Rezwan Hayat, had said. Tens of thousands of Rohingya who could not find room in the camps have cleared forests on the surrounding hills and set up shelters that have since been met with landslides every monsoon season. We have brought about 10,000 Rohingya to safety, safe places after their shelters were hit by heavy rain and landslides. At least 6 Rohingya were among the dead, and several others were injured, officials said. The other dead are local villagers whose homes were buried. Cox's Bazar district, where more than 850,000 Rohingya refugees are packed into 34 camps, have recorded more than 27 centimeters, that's about 10 inches, of rain since Monday, according to weather authorities. About 7,000 people outside the camps have also moved to safety, officials said. Muhammad Salam, a 30-year-old Rohingya, his wife and 3 children were among those moved. My house collapsed yesterday. I don't have anything. I have 3 children, and they have started having fevers, he said. United Nations Refugee Agency said 2,500 shelters housing 12,000 Rohingya have been affected by the floods. We are also aware of damage to facilities, including health centers, Hana McDonald, a UN spokesperson, had advised. Aid workers said a coronavirus lockdown in the camps following a major spike in cases has affected rescue work as authorities have halted what they consider non-essential visits. About 740,000 Rohingya fled Rakhine state in Myanmar after security forces launched a clampdown in 2017 that the United Nations said may amount to genocide. And last month, 2 Rohingya camps with refugees were killed in separate landslides during heavy rain. So very, very tragic circumstance, to say the least. My God, it's like a hell there. Unbelievable. One second. Evidently, 5 people are still missing a day after a huge explosion in a German chemical park are likely to be found alive. A site operator said Wednesday, urging residents not to touch possibly toxic soot from the blast. 2 people were already confirmed dead in the incident on Tuesday, which also injured 31 others. We have no hope of finding the missing alive, said Frank Hildmar, CEO of Chempark operator Currenta. Our thoughts are with the families, he added. Cause of the Tuesday morning blast at Chempark's waste incineration site in the western city of Leverkusen remains unknown, he told a press conference. The explosion, which was heard several kilometers away and rattled the windows of nearby homes, sent a cloud of black smoke into the air. The blast also triggered a fire in storage tanks for solvents that took firefighters hours to put out. And police closed several motorways in the area, and residents were told to stay indoors and shut their windows over concerns dangerous gases may have been released. Well, the warning remained in place for most of Tuesday until city authorities said air pollution measurements had shown no abnormalities. Experts are still probing whether soot particles that came down after the blast may be toxic, with a final report not expected for several days. Well, current Currenta chief operating officer Hans Genen had told residents not to touch any residue they might come across and to contact the authorities so samples could be taken. Locals have also been advised not to eat fruit or vegetables from their gardens and playgrounds in Leverkusen's Bürig und Opladen neighborhoods who are temporarily closed. We will do everything we can to get to the bottom of this terrible event, Currenta CEO Hildma had said. Four of the missing are Currenta employees, while the fifth works for an external company, he added. Of the 31 injured, one is in serious condition. All those affected worked at the chemical park. The area where the blast happened, in Leverkusen's Bürig district, is a short distance away from ChemPark's main industrial park that houses numerous chemical companies, including Bayer, Lanxess, and Evonik Industries. A report in Der Spiegel, the Mirror magazine, said that the blast was measured at as far as 40 kilometers away. It's about 25 miles away. Unbelievable. These things are happening too often, it seems. Either they're happening more often than ever before, or it's just that the reporting is such that we're getting much more information in a more timely manner, and that could just drive, you know, awareness more often, which is interesting. Now let's quickly look at some other issues. One second. This is interesting. Brussels says that about 70% of European Union adults have at least one COVID shot. So overall, 57% of over 18s are now fully vaccinated across the 27 nations. And these figures put Europe among the world leaders, von der Leyen had said. She's the European Union chief. Or commission president, European Commission president. So that's what she said. And let me see if we could just find some other things. One second here. All right, let's see where we go here. I'm looking for this. Evidently, Brazilians have united to protest against the vaccine scandal that's taken place in Brazil and Bolsonaro's COVID-19 response. So while the government vaccination campaign that took place this past weekend in Brazil has witnessed its fourth weekend of rallies against President Jair Bolsonaro's handling of the COVID-19 crisis and his anti-vaccine rhetoric. Tens of thousands came together in cities and towns across Brazil on Saturday, galvanized by the slow vaccine rollout and their president's spurning of safety measures to curb the virus. The 94% of Brazilians recently surveyed by Datafolha support the vaccine and said that they are either already vaccinated or intend to be. Only 5% of those surveyed say they haven't been vaccinated and don't plan to be in the future, despite having a head of state who has openly mocked COVID-19 as being no more than a little flu, and attacked the Pfizer vaccine by jokingly suggesting it could turn people into crocodiles. Support for vaccines among Brazilians on both sides of the political spectrum is growing. Well, I'm here against the government that I consider genocidal, college professor Adalberto Bissau Jr. told Agence France-Presse at the protest on Saturday. They are responsible for not purchasing vaccines, and many people died as a result. Bissau Jr.'s claim seems to resonate across political lines. Bolsonaro's failure to implement a coordinated national response to the pandemic and his general disregard for vaccines has been a unifying factor galvanizing the recent protests. Well, the center right, the center, and the left can all agree that his performance with COVID has been awful, says Professor of Brazilian Studies at King's College, Anthony Pereira. They'll disagree on his handling of the economy or the role of the military within the government. But this they cannot argue upon. Well, the president is already under investigation for allegedly turning a blind eye to the misuse of government funds when purchasing vaccines, and has seen the popularity ratings for him drop to 24%, the lowest since he took office in 2019. Bolsonaro has a knack for creating enemies out of his supporters, Pereira had said. Many many Bolsonaro voters who were sympathetic to his discourse on quarantine and lockdowns aren't necessarily sympathetic to what he says about vaccines, consequently swaying their political opinions, he added. Well, if you're a favela, you don't have a Brazil enjoys a long history of successful inoculation campaigns, another reason why so many are taking to the streets to demand better vaccine management. It seems that in 1973, during Brazil's military dictatorship, the National Immunization Program, PNI, was set up after a successful smallpox vaccination campaign completely eradicated the disease from the country. Well, then in 1986, Zé Gotinha, or Droplet Joe, was created. Considered a national treasure, he is a droplet-shaped mascot and cartoon character invented to reassure children and parents on the safety of the oral polio vaccination. 6 years after its creation, polio was eradicated in Brazil. Since then, the country has managed to eradicate tetanus, and measles as well. Zé Gotinha was an example of a strategic communication campaign, says director of King's Brazil Institute, Dr. Vinicius Mariano de Carvalho. He became the public image for inoculation and got into people's mentalities to such an extent that the portion of Brazilian society that is anti-vaccine today is very small. He reached everyone, even those who were less educated, he says, insisting that vaccination has become embedded in Brazilian culture since inoculation campaigns began back in the 1960s. So very, very compelling set of circumstances, to say the least. Okay, let's just move on. We only have a few minutes left, and then we'll be speaking to Mayor Sean Patterson Howard. 1 second here. Okay, this is most interesting. This is how I'm going to die, so says a policeman who testified at a congressional hearing on Capitol Hill. Four police officers delivered graphic, riveting testimony yesterday about their violent clashes with rioters while defending the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. As a congressional panel launched its probe of the deadly insurrection. While defying several Republican openly opposed to scrutinizing the attack, blamed on supporters of former President Donald Trump, the witnesses describing being punched, kicked, pepper sprayed, threatened with death, and branded traitors by a rampaging mob intent on blocking certification of Joe Biden's election victory. It was something from a medieval battle, Capitol Police Sergeant Aquilino Gonell had said. An immigrant U.S. Army Iraq soldier veteran told the panel as he wiped away tears. I recall thinking to myself, this is how I'm going to be defending. How else? So it's going to be very, very interesting where all of this stuff goes. A Metropolitan Police Department officer, Daniel Hodges, described how terrorists pushed through the line and engaged us in the hand-to-hand combat, with at least one rider trying to gouge out the policeman's eyes. The gripping accounts served as opening testimony in a landmark hearing, the House of Select Committee to investigate the January 4 attack, which opened with hair-raising victories that caused the situation to take place. So half a year after hundreds of Trump supporters conducted the worst assault in two centuries, more than 535 arrests related to the incident here. All right, so let's just see what we have here. 1 second. I'll go over to, I'll play a little commercial, and then we should be expecting the mayor to join us very shortly.
Hey, you a judge?
Sorta. I report on cheese. I don't judge.
Well, I heard on the radio, Cabot Cheddar always wins awards for taste.
Well, let me see my notes. Best taste? Check. Best texture? Check. The farm families in Cabot, Vermont have won every major award in the cheese world.
Every award?
Every.
What about the U.S. Cheese Championships?
Cabot's won that many times.
How about the American Cheese Society Contest?
Cabot won it.
World Cheese Championship Award?
Best in class on cheddar.
Fiery Food Challenge?
Cabot.
International Fancy Food Show?
Cabot rules.
The Stanley Cup?
That's hockey.
Oh.
Look, Cabot's won awards for best sharp, best light, best butter, and best cheddar.
Yeah, but a certain big cheese company's TV ad show, they won an award from judges wearing bright yellow lab coats.
Oh, those are actors.
Not real judges?
Real judges wear white lab coats.
They do.
Look, Cabot is best because they own the company, ship the milk, make the cheese. They won so many times, the real judges even asked one of Cabot's cheesemakers to be a judge.
I don't believe you.
Here, taste.
Hey, I can taste why Cabot's won every award.
You be the judge.
And I get to wear a yellow lab coat.
White lab coat. Check.
The best tasting cheddar on the planet is...
Time and time again.
Cabot Cheddar.
Check.
Welcome back. We're a few minutes away from Mayor Sean Patterson Howard. The mayor of the city of Mount Vernon is going to give us a call. So what's really interesting is that the city is still at a stalemate, because a lot of the collection of funds that are due the city from taxpayers that have been actually sent to the comptroller, we understand, have not been cashed by the comptroller. Bills that were supposed to be paid have not been paid, and either delayed or for such a long time that equipment is being recalled because of non-payment. I think one of the fire trucks was recalled because of non-payment. And so it goes on and on. This sort of tragedy goes on. What's really, I find, most compelling is that the city is suffering. The city is suffering the consequences of payments not being made in a timely manner, that the lack of services are due to a lack of paying employees, equipment being, not being taken care of, equipment that's been allowed to languish into total decay and just lack of capacity. We've got tire treads on DPW trucks that are so bare that just taking the truck out on the road could actually undermine the safety of people on the road, because in case one of these tires bursts, the entire truck come down and kill or hurt a lot of people. And so extremely dangerous situations that are taking place of late. And at the same time, there doesn't seem to be any mechanism when a controller who is an elected official decides on their own not to conform to the needs of the public interest. And so these are problems that cannot be expunged overnight. And what's fascinating is that the legal system, in other words, the courts may deliberate and even assert a position that it's inappropriate the way these things are being handled, but they don't come back with a forceful response that says, this can't go any further. This is the end of the line. There's no more discussion. The city's been under attack for over 2 years now, and nothing's been resolved. So I expect this money to be dispersed, and I expect all these things to be taken care of. And I give you 1 week or 2 weeks maximum to get it done, and I want an update every day of what has been done. And I don't see what's so difficult about that, unless there's a lack of will. The question is, a lack of will, why? Why is there a lack of will to get something done to benefit the city that has been hurt for so long? And this is not just these last 2.5 years. This is longer, going on through 4 years before that. When is it going to stop? Who's going to stop it? What's the mechanism to put an end to this tragedy, this travesty, this safety issue, this issue that continues on and on and on, and one has to wonder why, and why is it permitted to take place, which it has, in the city of Mount Vernon? Then what's to preclude this from not happening in another community somewhere else? And how long does one give, how long does one afford an elected official to do the job correctly? So in other words, if you mess up from day one after you're elected into office, there's nothing that can be done, and it can only be done if a person like that gets voted out of office at the next election, or if they decide not to run again, as in the case of Deborah Reynolds, she's not running again. Thank God for that, because I don't know if we could tolerate another 4 years of her. You know, nothing will survive that point. And then there are other issues as well. Is there no mechanism to put an end to this sort of travesty? It's not functioning well. It doesn't serve the public interest. Nobody's gaining from this. This is insanity. So since this is a reality, why is there no intervention from Comptroller Thomas DiNapoli, who's the New York State Comptroller? Why is there no capacity from the office of the governor of the state of New York to somehow intercede? Why is there no capacity by the court system to intercede on behalf of the public interest? We're talking anywhere between 80,000 to 100,000 people who reside in the city of Mount Vernon. I think it's the sixth largest city in the state of New York. And nothing's happening. So when is something going to happen? And do we have to just simply wait end of her term to finish? Do we have to wait till the end of 2021? What do we do if we get another, you know, person who doesn't have the capacity, the wherewithal, the knowledge, and the best practice to follow what every other individual with that responsibility as the controller of a particular community, evidently she doesn't have the qualifications. and she's proven her lack of capacity, and no one is able to say, hey, you know what? We don't want you to come to Mount Vernon anymore. We expect you to take a course. We'll give you a course. You'll have to spend 2 days a week to learn how it's all done. And every two days per week until she takes the entire course, and then she's got to pass it. And if she doesn't pass it, then out she goes, out the goddamn door. It's enough. And when are we going to get all these things done? And why don't we have people who literally review these sort of issues and simply say, hey, this is not working. Because it's not working, then maybe it's time for us to just simply close this person out, block her from having any capacity to enter into City Hall, and get an expert that knows how to unblock and rip through any of the safeguards that Ms. Deborah Reynolds has incorporated to lock out anybody else from ever viewing any information that is in her office. There's got to be a way around that. And if that's going to cost money, I would take it out of her salary as well. I would sue her for the money many times over because of the time it took place. And I don't understand why we don't have the legal minds to put that together. How long does it take? And I'm sorry if it seems like I'm getting antsy the last 6 months. But you know what? It's been going on. I've been antsy for the last 4 years. And the year before that. You know, what's going on? When does it stop? When is the public interest more important than someone being elected into office? Evidently, people voted for her because maybe they liked her, the way she looked, the way she spoke, whatever. But we didn't know if she had the capacity to do anything. Maybe it is time, for example, to bring back competency. Maybe if you want to run for a particular office that requires some form of competency, maybe it would be worthwhile to give them a course to demand a, if you're running for political office, whatever it is, if it requires your special knowledge, then you better take a course. Make sure you catch up. You don't have to have a college degree, but you need to be able to do the work. And if you're not able to do the work because you can't study it, you can't learn it, then who needs you? Then why are we voting for them? What's the point? Is someone trying to undermine the entire city? Are these people getting backup from other people who think it's okay, no problem? We can just play around with all these people, 100,000 people who are suffering effluent backup in their businesses, in their homes, in the everywhere you look. What else can go wrong? They don't even have a pickup of, certain types of pickup, like I think grass can't be picked up or is not being picked up. The equipment is not working. Police cars are parked and can't go anywhere because there isn't money to pay for gasoline. The cars are not up to par. They're no longer safe as well, not for the police and not for those people that are being sought by the police. I don't understand where this goes. I don't understand the purpose of maintaining it. I don't understand why we're permitting this to take place. And I don't understand how anyone could survive all of this. And I really wonder at the end of the day, is the public aware that this is not the fault of Sean Patterson Howard, the present mayor of the city, or its predecessors, Andre Wallace, who was there only for about 3 months, and also Richard Thomas, who was there for almost 4 years. What are these people doing? How are we going to get this resolved? Do people understand that the cops are not functioning because they don't have gas? Do we understand that the Dole Center that's supposed to serve people of a certain age, a senior community. This is where they gather. This is where they eat lunch. And there are times when the food wasn't even available. The mayor had to go into her pocket to pay for it. You know, when does it stop? When do we put an end to this atrocity that happened on our watch day in and day out? Is there no mechanism? The courts evidently don't have the capacity to get it done. Is it even conceivable that the Westchester County District Attorney can arrest this woman for not doing her job, for not paying the bills, for not collecting the payment, for all of these things that haven't transpired under her watch? Or are we going to give her a free ride? This is a person that needs to spend the rest of her time in jail, certainly till the end of the time for her term, and then maybe she should be kept in jail for a little further for all the pain she has caused by non-payments and the precarious safety situation that could be suffered by the city as this continues. I don't comprehend any of this. This goes way over my head. I don't understand what's behind it, who's behind it. Is there anyone behind it? Is there just a bias against the city of Mount Vernon? And why would that be? Just don't understand how long we would give this anomaly in governance to continue unabated. And you know what? Even the terminology that you hear nowadays about Ms. Reynolds not doing this way or that thing that way, and that it doesn't really serve the public interest. Well, that's great. I'm glad you have an opinion. Can you do something about it? And if not, who cares what your opinion is? This is not, you know, this is not a poll. What do you think is right? It's all wrong. It's all wrong because the public is not being protected. It's all wrong because the cops cannot do the best job that they must do. And it goes on and on and on. You don't hear the clergy speaking eloquently about these concerns. And it's not about giving somebody a job, but it's about, you know, getting something done. And the only thing that can be done is either to dismiss her or to await her departure. Now I think in order for the courts not to really get involved, they're just placating this crisis, and they can't wait till the 1st of January when the present comptroller of the city of Mount Vernon is going to be out of a job because she won't be running for the election. Is this insanity or what? This is an absolute insanity. It boggles my mind that we've been permitting this thing to take place for such a long time. And now we're also starting to hear finger-pointing and witnessing finger-pointing. Everybody's not doing the right thing. This one's not doing the right thing. Another one's not doing the right thing. Really? Is that the best you can do? What is the right thing? Who's going to do the right thing? What is it going to take? How much is it going to cost? And that makes it very, very difficult. Well, so there you have it. An unbelievable circumstance of atrocity. It's just permitted to cause the city to languish while we are in the throes of COVID-19. So many things are going wrong, and yet there isn't an outcry. You don't hear it anywhere. Oh, looks like the mayor is on the line with us now. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
Good morning, Hezzy. Sorry I'm running a few minutes late. Let's cut our time
in
half.
No, I understand. No, I understand. So that's good. Just being able to talk to you is very, very helpful. You know, I'm wondering how much longer can the city suffer this pain that it's going through now? Crisis evidently emanated from the Office of the Comptroller, that has not followed best practices, has not collected funds to the city, or if they have, they haven't been deposited. And she certainly hasn't dispensed the money that's been necessary. The equipment is falling apart. Equipment has to be set to the side because you can't use it. Effluence is going through the streets. They're going in housing, in businesses. I don't know what else can go wrong. But there's no mechanism to help. What do we do for the next 6 months? How do you manage the city for six more months?
We're at 5 months and a week now, which sounds better than 6 months, but it's still a long time.
It does.
It's still a long time to struggle. It's still a long time to operate in unnecessary crisis. We've spoken about some of our capital needs and so far as equipment. But right now, at the same time, our municipal buildings, several of them should be condemned. The armory, where we house a senior program and our handicap program, our Rose Simon program for our children with physical and other disabilities, we've had to close that building right now. The building has really been in disrepair for many years. You continue to use it because you don't have anything else. You force your residents to receive kind of second-rate Mount Vernon's operated in such a state of dysfunction for so long that operating in dysfunction and just finding ways to hold it together with Band-Aids and bubble gum became a skill set and just the norm. And always saying, okay, well, this broke, now we can do this, now we can do this, now we can do this. The Armory and the Dole Center.
All these things that are taking place, and it's all gone downhill because of the crisis that emanates from the comptroller's office. Okay, we may not be able to resolve anything until she gets out of office, and then hope to God that whoever gets in position of the comptroller is going to have the capacity, the will, the drive to fix these things and to get it moving by following best practices. What do we do? And there's no mechanism, evidently. That's the thing that offends me. There is no mechanism to put an end to this. You don't see it from the court. You don't see it from government. You don't see it from the New York State Comptroller. There seems to be nothing to save the pain and the struggle and even the survival of the city because there just doesn't seem to be a mechanism. What do we do in the future? I don't want to cry crazy right now, but I'm very worried. I don't know how you can say anything.
We're in a dire situation. We're in a dire situation. Yeah. You know, we have so much promise and potential just around the corner, but we have to be able to get out of our own way. We have to be able to get out of our own way. And so everything that I'm speaking about today is not just the comptroller, but her inaction, her lack of willingness to work with us has exacerbated it. So the fact that we have old garbage trucks, you know, that predated her. But we haven't done anything in the past 10 years to invest in our fleet of garbage trucks. We haven't done much in the past 10 years to invest in our fleet of police cars. We did get some used police cars, I think, back in 2016 or 17, you know, but again, it was a Band-Aid to kind of help get us through a rough patch. You know, fire engines, we brought our first ladder truck in the city of Mount Vernon last year, and that was the first ladder truck that we purchased in 20 years. The armory is a very old building. You know, military armory, and we've been utilizing it as a municipal building, but we've put no investment in that building. It's pretty embarrassing, and, you know, but we kept saying, well, it's all we had, and it's better than not having anything. But at this time, we've had to close it. It's been closed for over a year because of COVID, but as we were looking to bring the seniors and our young people back into the building over over the past year since it's been closed because of COVID, and then not maintained, not kept up, not invested in, not repaired. Before it closed, there were trees and vines and bushes growing in the Dole Center. Why are outside vegetation growing in a building? It's because, you know, the foundation of the building is broken, and you should not have vines running along the walls in an office. You just shouldn't have it, and this is the condition that we've operated many of our municipal buildings.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the reality that is already there. It's evident. I don't know if all the people in Mount Vernon or any other place have a clue to all the different deficiencies wherever you look. And certainly you mentioned items today that I was unaware of.
We came in here on Monday, and the basement was flooded. We walked in, and the basement of the city, you know, hall had flooded after the heavy rains. You know, we had sewage backup. That's not the first time we've had.
No.
We were closed in the middle of the winter because our boilers went down because there wasn't current maintenance. But you know, historically, have not invested in capital repairs that we've needed in our city. And then when you look at the larger issue,
delineating all of this stuff though. It may be wise to delineate them so you can have a complete list of all the things where there's a deficiency. I don't even know if there's enough time to put that all together. But is there a way for the city to get a bond in order to go through
the
process?
We have no bond rating.
You have no bond rating.
We have our bond rating.
And is there any facility, anything?
I believe.
Uh-huh.
It was either late 2018
or 2019. Is there any other facility available to the city to be able to get out of its financial way? Or is this it?
I don't think that we'll be able to do much, unfortunately, and really move forward solidly until January when a new comptroller comes in and we know the financial state of the city. It's very hard for us to get, you know, even high entrance bonds right now because we don't have a bond rating. But we haven't had a completed audit since 2016. She won't provide access to the books. So it's hard to go out and borrow. I don't care if it was 50% interest rate. No one's going to lend us money when we can't show them the financial condition of the city, the financial status of the city. And so that's a real challenge. In January
So why isn't there a mechanism to be able to pry this information loose so that the city can decide whether or the people who give the bonds or sell the bond can actually go to market.
We've gone to court over and over and over again.
I know.
Richard Thomas went to court. The court told them to, you know, her to give access to the information. We went to court for the same thing. She was told to give access to the information. But the courts can so order, but if the courts don't enforce by following up when we say that she's not complying, they don't want to hold her in contempt, then there's nothing to do. So we can get 50 orders issued if no one,
no one
is willing to do the enforcement.
Why? She's one person, and you got another 100,000 people who are suffering because of this one person who won't do the work.
We've heard judges.
We've
heard
judges,
we've heard elected say that Mount Vernon is messy, it's been messy, it's not their job to run the government. They are far too involved in the operations of city government than they really, really want to be. They have very full caseloads. And the amount of time that it takes to dig through all of this for them is overwhelming. You know, we know that people go back to the time of
who
do you
believe.
She's
not paying the bills. She's not paying the bills. What is there to dig through? She's not even collecting the money.
I think I'm usually an articulate person, but
You are very articulate.
All you could do is stutter when you speak about this, because it's hard to complete a sentence that makes sense in a situation that makes no sense. There's just no way to explain this away. There's no way to get people to fully understand the impact of this one person obstructing governmental operations and how that impacts everything that flows through City Hall. It impacts people selling their homes. It impacts taxes being collected.
Yeah, the most powerful job evidently in Mount Vernon and probably in other places too is the controller.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the big question is, is there some sort of a bias by the court system or the state that says we got to protect the controller, but
I just don't think people want to use their political capital to become involved in this messy issue.
What about your capital? What about the capital of all the people in government in the city of Mount Vernon?
When you don't have to look at them and listen to them every day, it just becomes noise that you can ignore. And so the further away you are from this city, the easier it is for people to look the other way. You know, everyone has their challenges, and no one is hyper-focused on what's happening in Mount Vernon other than those of us who are in Mount Vernon every day. The sense of urgency and the crisis level that we are operating in is like DEFCON 10. You just feel like you're going to push the nuclear button any moment or we're going to implode. So it's very difficult. It's a difficult environment to operate in. But I have to give so much credit to my team. To my leadership team and to our staff all the way down to the direct levels. People are complaining about what's not being done, but they do not understand so many of the extra steps that we have to take just to keep the city running. Nothing as exciting is happening right now. We haven't given service delivery to the next level, but the fact that we're still delivering services, and I know we shouldn't ask people to be excited about that, but if you have no equipment, if people are not being paid, if they're not allowing us to hire people and she's blocking that, if we don't have parts to fix cars and trucks, but yet we're still showing up to the police calls, to the fire calls, to pick up the garbage, this situation could be worse. The staff, the amount of time that we have to spend as the leadership team continuously encouraging and feeding our staff that is feeling very demoralized, very overworked, very underappreciated, very under-resourced, and they are oftentimes digging into their pockets to get some of the equipment they need just to do their job. And they're the lowest paid in the county.
Nothing would work without them anyway.
The community is so frustrated that, you know, hurt people hurt people. Angry people lash out. People who feel abused, you know, our residents in this community, understandably, have not PTSD. They have CTSD. Mm. They have chronic traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
Because it's been a chronic stress that has happened in Mount Vernon for a long time. Post would mean it was over. But we are still living in a high level of stressful situations. And so, you know, Mount Vernon is not unique. We're like any place in the country. Across the country over the past 5 to 10 years, confidence in government has declined nationwide. Yeah. So, you know, whether you're Democrat, Republican, whether red state, blue state, northeast, southwest, midwest, rural, suburban, urban, it doesn't matter. And so, in general, trust in government. And when you have a government that has not functioned, misfunctioned, malfunctioned, it makes it even worse. And so regardless of how hard you are working, everyone says be transparent. And then when you're transparent, then they're like, you're talking about our dirty business in public and people are laughing at us. Well, my mother always told me a closed mouth doesn't get fed. And so if we're not telling people what our sewer issues are, if we're not talking about our equipment issues, if we continue to operate with unsafe equipment, you know, so we had to let a glass ball drop. The glass ball dropped. We reached out. We received help. People missed garbage collection for one day. For one day.
Mm-hmm.
The garbage did not pile up in the streets. You know, yes, it was a hot day, but you missed garbage collection for one day. And I think that's pretty commendable that we were able to reach out to partners and get help. We were able and that they responded and that our workers came in, even though they don't get paid overtime, and worked on Saturday and Sunday to make sure that they collected all of the garbage throughout the city so that we could get back to a regular collection schedule.
Mount Vernon matters, so. I'm glad you're at the helm because I believe that you're going to be able to hold it together. I don't know how you do it, but I pray that you continue to have the strength to do it. Prayer
and the patience of our staff and the patient and even the frustrated support of our residents.
Absolutely.
Because while they are frustrated and they fuss, many of them understand, and some will never understand, because of political tribalism in Mount Vernon, and chaos makes some people, that's the only relevance that they have, is to cause chaos, trouble, and kind of keep things going and the negative going. You know, you're always going to have them, but you can't focus on them. You have to keep doing your job.
You got to forgive me. I have to say goodbye because they're going to shut us down.
Now
I'm going to cut mid-sentence. So I just have a great week. People love Mount Vernon. So I can't wait to speak to you next week. Hang in there.
Looking forward. Take care. Be
well.
Enjoy.
Bye. Thank you. Bye. There we are, folks. We'll speak to you not tomorrow, no show tomorrow, but on Friday.